When the Cuyahoga County prosecutor released two reports asserting that Cleveland police officers acted reasonably in shooting a 12-year-old boy holding an air pistol within seconds of arriving on the scene, it was seen by many as preparing the public for the fact that the prosecutor would not be strenuously pursuing indictment of the officers before the grand jury. And for many, that's depressing but not terribly surprising. There are some who believe law enforcement don't make mistakes, or any mistakes they make should be overlooked because they have a hard job. Those that don't share that view look to the legal system to bring justice when police officers fail. But every day brings evidence that that faith is misplaced, that the mechanisms that in theory should serve as checks on police power either exist in theory more than in practice or don't exist at all. How can those outraged by police violence turn anger into change? Here to discuss the issue is Chase Madar. He's a civil rights attorney and the author of the book, The Passion of Chelsea Manning. Welcome to Counterspin, Chase Madar.
Great to be talking with you.
Well, the fatal shooting of Tamir Rice by Officer Timothy Lohman was heartbreaking. It didn't come out of the blue, though. The Cleveland Police Department has already been cited by the Justice Department for excessive force, for which officers are rarely disciplined. A 2013 investigation by the state attorney general found systemic failure. That was their term, systemic failure in the department. There's just a lot of wrong in this story, from the failure to vet Lohman, who had a terrible record, to the harassment of Rice's family. It's staggering. But now all the attention is on the prosecutor and the grand jury, as if some measure of justice will come from that process. But the law on police shootings just doesn't work the way that people might imagine it does it?
No, it doesn't. And it's important to face that head on from the very beginning. I think there's a very hardwired tendency among Americans in general, and liberals in particular, to think that even when things are going wrong, that the law is good and fundamentally on our side, that the law is synonymous with justice. And people like to think this, whether it's regarding the dysfunction of our financial system, that it must be the result of crime rather than the ordinary workings of our financial laws. People think that anything that goes wrong in wartime must be a crime, even though the laws of war are incredibly permissive and really have the function of licensing acts of lethal violence more than restraining it. And this goes double, triple, quadruple for police violence. In fact, the laws as they actually exist in the United States, not as we wish they might be, but as they actually exist, are incredibly deferential to police officers using lethal violence. And this is not just a matter of local aberrations in places like Ferguson, Missouri, or Staten Island. The laws really shielding police violence from accountability, that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it's a part of, you know, Supreme Court jurisprudence that police can really fire with a great degree of latitude.
Well, what is that legal underpinning? There's something called objective reasonableness that seems to get to the heart of the actual standard in play when police kill somebody.
In the 1985 landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Tennessee versus Garner, the court set up an objectively reasonable standard for whether or not a police officer can use lethal force. And, of course, this sounds wonderful. I mean, what could be better? Objectively reasonable standard? You've got to be objective. That's good. And reasonable, who could be against that? But the way this has worked out in actual practice in courts, and including the Supreme Court and subsequent decisions about police violence, is that it is incredibly deferential to police officers. It's really what seemed objectively reasonable to the police officer at that moment, without any second guessing being allowed, without any hindsight being allowed. And it's more of a subjectively reasonable test. Now, there are limits. I don't want to say that absolutely anything goes. But if there's any conceivable way to justify what a police officer has done, it's probably going to hold up in court. And those of us who know the law were therefore not so surprised by the no bill of indictment handed down for the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, or by the police strangulation of Eric Garner in Staten Island, which also came up with a no bill of indictment in the grand jury. And what I mean by that is these cases were not even brought to trial. They were deemed by the grand jury to be not trial worthy, not strong enough. Looking at the other mechanisms where you think might be able to restrain police violence or to control and regulate the police use of violence, they usually come up empty-handed too. You might think that suing a police department would, okay, it doesn't result in a criminal conviction or a prison sentence for police officers, but shouldn't that install good behavior or better behavior? Shouldn't that incentivize good behavior? Surely the financial hit of a big multimillion-dollar payout will set up a new incentive structure and will deter bad behavior in the future. It makes common sense, but it turns out to be all wrong. In fact, the payouts that police departments routinely give out, especially in big cities, that money does not come from police department budgets at all. It comes from usually a general city budget. The individual police officer at fault doesn't have to pay any money himself or herself. And in New York City, even if there's a successful suit against a police officer, I was told by Ron Kuby, a veteran civil rights litigator who sues the police routinely, that the report of this lawsuit won't even be put in a police officer's permanent record or in his or her file.
Ultimately, the taxpayer is paying for...
Yes. Ultimately, it's the taxpayer. I mean, that's the cruel irony of this.
I think people want police who kill people who pose no threat to them to go to jail, just like criminal bankers, not because they think jail fixes everything. I think it's the double standard that galls, you know, the one law for me, another for thee. We have people doing life without parole for marijuana offenses. But if we want institutional change, how far would even criminal prosecutions go toward achieving that?
They should be used, and they should even result in conviction sometimes. But if we want real institutional change, then I think we're going to have a different focus and a broader focus than that, because criminal prosecutions, using that as the spear tip, really doesn't seem to work to reform police departments, to change police behavior. And I think when it comes to reforming police departments and police behavior, it's either go big and look at the really big picture, or just, you know, that's just the only way, or nothing.